get Pastor Larry to sign it later.
I'm getting there. It's giving me a fit with your presentation, but I got it working now.
So I think it's a great program.
Let me set this camera to go, and then we'll be ready to go.
But you got to find the clipboard.
Not yet, George. I want to make sure it's quality teaching first, and then I'll sign it.
Oh, okay. You going to give him a grade?
No.
A 1 through 5 stars?
I'm not qualified. He's got 3 times the amount of experience in VR that I've got.
But you got that performance edge on him.
Anyway, good afternoon, and thank you all for... Is everybody here? Soon. Anyway, glad that you all are here. My name is Alan Cahoe. I'm from the Blue Ridge Association. I'm the leader of Recovery Number 1. In May of 2000, we met Ellen Yudovich. She came to Faith Baptist Church and did a disaster relief class. It was the first time we'd ever heard of disaster relief in Southern Baptist. And we've been, our church and our association have been active in disaster relief ever since. When we were first trained in 2000, the state had one feeding unit. It was actually a feeding unit that was shared between Maryland, Delaware, and Pennsylvania, and a few others. That was the only resources that we had back then. To where we have now, we have 2 feeding units in the state. We have about, on the numbers, we have about 6 recovery units. Probably about 4 of them are deployable right now. 2 shower units. We've had a Winnebago mobile command and communications truck that's now out of service, and we're looking at our future for communications and command vehicles, one of the things that's on our radar to put together. So we've grown a lot. The first recovery unit is Maryland, Delaware, number 1, and that is our current trailer, picture of it up there. That's our second trailer for the unit, and that trailer has deployed, or that our unit has deployed 28 times since it came into existence, was commissioned in April of 2002. So I am a very type 1 class A personality. I come from public safety. My experience is we wait, we get a call, we flip the lights and sirens on, and we rock and roll. When our church and our association decided to do disaster relief in the year 2000 and get a recovery unit, it took us 2 years to put that unit, the original trailer, together, which drove me insane that it took so long. It was commissioned on April the 27th of 2002. Date is etched in my mind because 28 hours after it was commissioned, an F5 tornado went through La Plata, Maryland, and our unit was on its first deployment. God's timing was absolutely perfect. He even gave us 28 extra hours. So expect in what you do with us in disaster relief, expect to see God show up at strange places and do strange things. We see it all the time. It doesn't even faze us anymore. We see it so much. And I can tell you several stories of just God showing up and things happening. And what we refer to as divine appointments. Ellen talked about people that you want to deal with, you know, and obviously we want to take care of the less fortunate, the people who do not have the means and capabilities of recovering from a storm, a disaster. But that's not always who we deal with, because every once in a while, God wants us to interact with somebody else because that person needs to know Jesus Christ. And that is our most important function. We cut down trees, we move mud, we do all of these things so we have the opportunity to share Jesus Christ. If you look in the Bible, every time there was a situation like that, Christ always took care of people's human need, and then he gave them the gospel. Then he talked to them about spiritual. And that's what we do. We are earning the right to talk to you. When people ask, what do we cost? What is it? How much would it be for us to do get this tree off of this room or off of this house or whatever? And the answer is 15 minutes. We'll take care of this. I just want to sit there and have a chat with you about 10 to 15 minutes. When we're all done, we just want to sit there and talk for about 10 to 15 minutes. That's what it's going to cost you. That's that 10 minutes. So we can talk. Down in South Carolina, it is a very biblically experienced community, Bible Belt. They know who Southern Baptists are. They know the, you know, they may not be saved, but they at least have heard about Jesus. They're not opposed to it. In the last 2 years, my unit has been in New England four times to areas that they did not know Christ. I mean, to the point that to them, they knew about as much about Christ as I know about Hercules and all them other Greek mythologies. We were dealing with people who were would outright tell you that they were atheists. People that were skeptical of two words, Southern and Baptist. Yet we were going to minister to them. Okay? And that's why we're there. I can tell you out of experiencing that New England area, and one of the greatest things was last year we were up, and best thing in the world as a recovery unit, the best thing in the world they can ever do to you is to sit there and put you into a little community where there's a little mission church. Greatest thing in the world. I love it. You know, we were working out of Barrie, Vermont last year, and they said, hey, there's this little tiny community down south of us, and there's a Southern Baptist missionary there trying to get a church open, and he's trying to reach his community, and we're going to assign you down there, and you're going to work with him, and he's going to direct you to where people need. And we get to put boots on the ground, so this missionary pastor has been trying to make inroads into this community, and we get to be able to put boots on the ground for him to show the love of Christ in real time. I love that. That is, to me, the greatest experience you can have to help that. And he was great because he understood us. That pastor, he understood us so well because he had his little storefront church right next to his little New England store kind of thing, you know, the little general store. And he made an arrangement with them that anybody come in a gold shirt, give them free ice cream. So we could go in there and get ice cream anytime we wanted. So that was cool. So he understood us. But to be able to work in that community. But that pastor was telling us that every year there's a group of a coven of Wiccan or modern day witches that go up on the mountain and pray over that community that Christ does not return to that community. Yet here we are telling people about Christ in that community. That's what we're about. Okay? We learned about dealing with folks that are opposed to us. Start off the conversation. We had a lot of the multi-letter group people up there start the conversation off of, nobody likes to be stereotyped. They can agree with that. And then we say, we're stereotyped. You think of us as Southern that we don't know what we're doing, and as Baptists that we hate everybody. Why would I drive 12 hours to get up here if I hated you? Now their brain is starting to smoke a little bit. And I never take people in our trailer. There's one agnostic, very, very definite atheist person. I walked him out to my trailer, and I walked him through that trailer, and I showed him every piece of equipment on it. And it was like, this is not some ad hoc thing. We threw this together just to come up here. 36 churches in our association pool their money together to put all of this equipment on this trailer, quality stuff, so we can come out and help people. Would we do that if we hated you? Now they're curious. And I'll say, I don't know what you believe. I can only tell you what I believe. I believe the Bible, God, heaven, hell, Satan, Jesus. I believe every part of that is absolutely 100% real. And the greatest gift I was ever given was my relationship with Jesus Christ. The greatest gift. And the only thing I want to do is share that with you. I want to share my greatest gift with you. Would I do that if I hated you? And you can just literally see the smoke coming out. Not that they're mad, but you have just completely fried their brain. And now we give them a Bible and pray with them. And we prayed with that atheist. He let us put our hands on him and pray for him. He did not accept Christ there, but he took the Bible. I'll give you a clue on your associational and units. When you give out Bibles, we put a sticker on the back of the Bibles that has all of what people refer to as God's emergency numbers. Because we tell people, hey, in this book is where you find peace, love, joy, comfort from anxiety and all of this. But if they've never held a Bible, they don't know where to find that. So we put that on the back. Where to find, you know, if you're struggling with anxiety, fear, whatever, here are the scriptures to go to. Here's where you start. So do that to your, set your stuff up that way. And then we pray when we get back to our sort of private areas. We just pray that curiosity will cause them to open that Bible. At some point in time, their curiosity, the Holy Spirit, keep poking at them. And at some point in time, they may open that Bible and see what we're talking about, where peace, love, joy is. That's what a recovery unit does. How we do it is what we're going to talk about over the next hour and a half. Okay? Oh, this one doesn't do anything. You got to change it. There you go. So, Ellen already spoke about sort of our organization, Disaster Relief. We are part of North American Mission Board's Send Relief program. If you have a trailer like mine, and there's two of them out here, no, you can't take the Send Relief stuff off the trailer. I would love to, but you're not allowed to. Send Relief is a large umbrella organization that also includes a lot of untrained people. We call them the blue shirt people. Their shirts are blue. Send Relief. And their idea is to be able to take untrained volunteers and use them in a disaster as well. But they are not doing what we do. Okay, we are the specialist. We're the ones that are have specialized training. And that we're credentialed. Where this credential comes in, what makes this important, is every once in a while you'll get into situations, particularly tornadoes, fresh tornadoes, where the local government or the National Guard has the area cordoned off. They will not let people in. This gets you in. That's why we have the background checks. That's why we have the credentials and all that. We have had, as I say, several times in my disaster career, we have gone past National Guard guys, flashed our ID, and they've been briefed to accept that and let us in where other people cannot go. They get truly into the hot zone. Okay, that's why this is all important. Okay? Again, other people don't have that privilege that we have and the reputation of this National Southern Baptist Disaster Relief gives us that reputation and that ability. Recovery unit operations. Next one. Oh, yeah, you got it. Right on it. So we do feeding unit support. 2004, the very first trip of Maryland Delaware Recovery Unit number one out of the state. Our first out-of-state deployment. We were, if you remember, that 2004 was the year that four hurricanes went across Florida, one right after the other. We were en route to Florida to be a relief crew for the first hurricane. When the second hurricane made a turn in the Atlantic and came right at them. In the old days, when you traveled out of state, every 4 hours you had to call the North American Mission Board headquarters at Alpharetta, Georgia, and report your location. And as we were doing that, going down 95, When we got a check-in, they said, your orders have been changed. You are to go to a church at Richmond Hill, Georgia. And they gave us the address. And you are to go there and stay and wait. And we're like, for what? What's going on? Just do it. So we go down 95, just south of Savannah, Georgia. We pull off at Richmond Hill, and there's a Baptist church, and there's a local deacon. He opens the doors and lets us into this church, and there's six of us from Maryland, and we're in this gigantic church by ourselves, not having a clue of what's going on. Shortly afterwards, a whole bunch of everybody else comes in. They were evacuating all of the units that were in Florida, evacuated them up to Richmond Hill to where we were. Now we are surrounded by a whole bunch of people, and now we're starting to get a clue what's going on. The hurricane literally goes over top of us, and the next day we are heading down. Now, the units that they sent out that they evacuated from Florida were mostly North Carolina feeding units. They didn't want the feeding units on the ground when the hurricane went over because they didn't want them get tore up. So they sent them out, and now we were assigned, because we were a recovery unit, we were assigned to one of the North Carolina feeding units, and we were to escort them in. I mean, literally the wind had just stopped blowing enough that we could drive down 95, and we are leading the convoy and clearing as you go anything in the road. Don't wait for the local government. Clear it. And we get to this little church at Cocoa, Florida, and the church is damaged, and there's debris all in the parking lot. Get all of that cleared out and help the feeding unit become operational, because the people down there now had not had food. So the top priority for us, so that's what we call supporting that feeding unit, getting that thing operational. We don't know anything about feeding units, know very little about them, but that's what we were to do. We were to assist them and get them operational. Once we had that, now we were cut loose to go out in the field and start doing, you know, our thing out there. Damage assessment, also very important. I will tell you, one of the things you have to understand about being on the local team, so if, let's just say you guys here on the Eastern Shore, if you're ground zero where something bad happens and you realize quickly that this is a big event, don't be so rushing to grab your chainsaws and go out and start cutting on things, okay? What's more important is for you to start doing the damage assessments, finding out what's wrong. Let's get new numbers, how many homes are affected, how much do we have to do, so that as you're calling out saying, hey, we need the guys from Western Maryland, and we probably pull a couple of guys out of Pennsylvania to come down, but before those other recovery units arrive, you have to have jobs ready for them. You've got to know where to send them when they arrive, because nobody wants to come travel for hours, show up on your place, and say, yeah, we still don't know where we're sending you. We don't have your job set up. So the local team, that's your top priority at that point. You need to get the assessments done, figure out how big this, you know, how widespread this is, how many counties. You guys know your churches. Where are we going to, you know, is this church going to be a base camp? How many people can you sleep in this church? How many people can you feed out of this church? That's something you need to know. Your DOM needs to know that, you know, for your area. What churches are you going to send somebody to? You know, if you come to Frederick County, we're going to put you at Faith Baptist. It's a large facility. It's got everything we need. You know, but we need to know that. So again, locals, you become just invaluable. You have to be the local information so that everybody coming to back you up can hit the ground running. Obviously, we do chainsaw operations. That's the fun part. Get to play with the big toys. We also do emergency repairs, or what we call dry-in. We do flood and mud out operations. That's the sucky job. Salvage and cleanup sometimes. And yeah, she loves mud. She don't want to play with the chainsaw. And then other support operations that we deal with. So the recovery unit, that's a picture of the original recovery one. Obviously, chainsaws, gasoline powered. We're actually getting away from a lot of the gasoline powered pumps because we really not use them. I have my old recovery unit. We had a 250 gallon per minute gasoline powered trash pump. And in the 20 years that rig, we never used it. The only time it was ever used was either for my pool or Mike Rice's pool. We never used it in the field because most of the time we don't get called in to do a flood out mud recovery until the water's gone. Okay? So we do have electrical pumps, so if you get small amounts of water, fans, you need ventilation, ladders, hand tools. It is a gigantic toolbox on wheels. Your assessment officer, again, we're talking back about that. You're going to scout the areas for families. You need to come up with the size of the affected area, approximate number of families that are affected. We need to know that. And you need to be communicating with your local emergency manager. When Crisfield got hit in, I forgot what year it was, but Hurricane Sandy, okay, the little county that Crisfield was in, their emergency management office consisted of one person, the county emergency manager, and he didn't even have a secretary. He was clueless, and I'm not faulting him. He there was no way one person could get eyes on everything that was going on. He was overwhelmed from the get-go. Again, not his fault. One person can't do all that, and that's all he was, a one-man shop. We ended up collecting information, and in fact, Maryland Delaware Baptist, we have modified some of our forms so that we model our information collection on a Maryland State MEMA form so that if we need to be the eyes for the local emergency manager, we can put it in a format that they're going to understand and recognize immediately. And it is imperative that we get that information to them. For a disaster to get federal assistance, it needs to meet certain criteria. It has to be over a certain dollar amount of loss. It has to involve a certain amount of people, a percentage of the population. So again, collecting that information is vital. Other thing why we collect information about your hours in a storm, your hours are worth $18 for every hour that you put in. You don't get the $18, but the local government can take that and apply that to basically their deductible. So yes, the local government, to get federal money, has to prove that they put so much of their own resources into the event, and part of those resources is our volunteer hours. So that's helping the community reach the threshold to get to that federal declaration. So it's all things that we do. Provide assistance, prayer, support. That's the first contact. Usually we like to send an assessor and a chaplain out together. And they are the first point of contact. And you have no idea what you run across. People that are distraught, people that are handling it well. We had one situation here in the state of Maryland. Our chaplain and their assessors going down the street knocking on doors, and they get to this one house and it's obviously damaged. Knock on the door and a lady answers the phone or answers the door, and they, hey, we're Southern Baptist, we're here to help. We can get this tree and you know, we're be happy to help you. And she goes, I'm not worried about it. You're not worried about that giant tree that's up against your house? No, don't care. Talk to her a little bit more, and then they discover that she had gone through a whole series of events, and that in her mind, this was the last straw, and that she was planning to commit suicide. And our assessor and chaplain have now discovered this. Congratulations. You've got a problem to solve. And that's where your training and experience. And in that situation, they had to call in the local authorities and get local authorities involved in it to basically save this woman's life. So it happens. You don't know what you're going to run across. So It's an important job, important to be trained at, and it's important to have your chaplains that are ready for that, and you put them together. Keep stepping on this thing back here. Sorry about that. In Maryland, Delaware, we follow what's called the National Incident Management System. So that's nationally, there's a management system that we're all supposed to follow. And part of that is their priority. So we follow the NIMS priority, a priority one for any job to be listed as a priority one job. It is a life safety issue. That damage or whatever it is, if it is left uncorrected, it poses a threat to somebody. It could hurt somebody. Okay, now we were just in South Carolina where the South Carolina authorities were saying a priority one job was Little Miss So-and-so because she was a member of such and such pastor's church. Okay, that's not a priority one job to us. Priority one job to us is if we do not correct this, it's going to hurt somebody. A priority two job is if we do not correct this, it's going to continue to allow the house to be damaged. So it's incident stabilization. So if you have a tree on the roof, a hole in the roof, that's priority two because we need to get the tree off and we need to put a patch over that hole so your house doesn't get more water and more damage. Okay, that's us, a priority two. And then priority three is incident, just environmental cleanup. That's your general chainsaw work. Most of your mud out work is considered environmental cleanup, things like that. So priority two, do the work so the house doesn't get any further damage and the people can remain living in it. And priority three is just your general cleanup. And next one. Yes, sir.
Is that PowerPoint available or is that in the book or anything?
Probably not. If you want, or I can just. Yeah, I mean, it follows NIMS. It follows the National Incident Management. Well, in your thing that Ellen gave you earlier, you should have resources. It used to be required that everybody in disaster relief had to have NIMS, National Incident Management System training, which is available free online from FEMA. They do not require that anymore. But pretty close to the 9/11 time frame and the 8 years after 9/11, that presidential administration required people to have that training. And then after that, it kind of fell away. But it's still good training. It explains how the national management system works, and it answers a lot of questions people have. All right, next. So chainsaw operations, obviously we're going to remove down trees, trees that have damaged things, like the poor little Honda. Sorry, we can't save the Honda. Emergency dry-in, the next one. So this is Brother Mike Rice. You can't see this. This is an interesting story of this house. This is in Mico, Florida, 2004. Somebody had the bright idea of putting several, probably like 2,000 of these double-wide trailers a mile and a half off of the Atlantic coast in Florida and then fill that with old people. And then this hurricane comes through. This is Hurricane Jean, the fourth of the four hurricanes of that year. And it tears this little place apart. And if you don't know, inside of hurricanes, tornadoes run around inside of hurricanes. So the house directly next to this little old lady, who's living in this house, she was not there. They were evacuated during the storm. But the house next to her, the little double wide next to her, was a direct strike from a tornado. And it just missed this house. So the house next to her is completely gone. And all of the debris was shotgunned out. So the side of her house looked like somebody just sat there and pumped a shotgun into it. It was holes all over it. So what Mike Rice is doing, again, you can't see if the way the picture is, we actually are taking pieces of the house that is now in nothing but pieces and using caulk to caulk over the holes and patch this lady's house because she was adamant she was staying in her house. So it looked really weird when we were all said and done, and it's just this weird patchwork quilt of repairs on the side of her house. But we did get it watertight, and she was able to remain, and the insurance company eventually going to have to put a new siding on her house. But it's what we do. Allow people to try to stay in their home without further damage. Flood out, mud out. Again, generally do not pump water out of people's basements, usually because it's gone by the time we get there. Salvage operations. One of the jobs that we had on our first deployment in La Plata, Maryland, 2002, we were told to go to this house. Front of the house looked beautiful. Come around the back, and you talk about the power of a tornado. The back of this house looked like a little girl's doll set. You know, the little doll house. It's got the front and the back. It's just open. That's exactly what this house was. You could stand on the back, and the back side of the house was gone, and you can look and see pictures and stuff on the walls that stayed, but the whole back of the house was gone. And it took all of their stuff and spread it over a farm field. And this was our first deployment. We had a lot of ladies with us in the church that went out with us, and they formed a police line, if you know what that is. The military does that, you know, everybody line up. And we started walking this field and finding pictures and things, mostly pictures and stuff like that, and just picking it up, and at the end, be able to give that back to the family. We were able to find these things of yours that have not, they're not destroyed. Scuffed up a little bit, but not destroyed. And we were able to give that back to that family. So simple ministry like that. Sometimes you can't save the house or you can't do much, but maybe you can try to help get some of the salvageable things, protect them, and get those back to the family. So it's some of the things that we do. Administrative support, interview the families. Again, that's your assessors are going to do that. Bring that back. It'll get assigned a priority. And then our administrative people, this is important. Again, we're unfortunately a paperwork and computer-driven organization. There's lots of paperwork. There's lots of, it's just a lot of tracking that needs to happen. So having those people back at the base camp, that's invaluable. So if you're not comfortable being out in the field, but you have very good administrative backgrounds, we got a place for you too. Okay, because you've got to be able to track all this. We have to know where every one of these jobs are at any given point in time. It is incredible the need that we have there. This is Mico, Florida again. Little Baptist church there was damaged in the storm, but this is my shout out to them because even though they were damaged, you can see the sign. It says temporary help, sign up here. For that church, they stayed in business. And they stayed helping their community. And they were reaching out to that community. And that's imperative. If you're the home church, to be able to continue to reach out and let them know. Because there may be people you've been trying to reach for years. There's a little church in Maryland City that had been trying to reach their community for years and closed doors. And then that one storm hit, and they were the only building in the area that still had power. And the pastor, God bless him, he took a risk. He was short on money. His church was financially struggling. And he said, I'm going for broke. He went out and bought all the food he could, brought it back to church, started cooking and giving the food out to the people. Then called Ellen. And we sent resources in and backed him up. And again, this little church that's been struggling, trying to reach this community, you know, those doors aren't closed anymore. And that church is able to reach that community. God has a funny sort of way of getting people's attention every once in a while. But if it weren't for that pastor saying, you know what, we're almost broke, go for broke, throw everything at it, faith. And the willingness to answer God's call. So I love that when I heard that story and it's like, yeah, baby, our unit will be right there. We will be there to help you out. We're gonna be there for you. That's cool. That's when you get to do fun ministry. Small engine tech. If there's anybody in your group that knows how to run, repair small engines. What we do to chainsaws in the field is pretty hard. I mean, we use professional grade saws and they're still not designed for what we do with them. So having somebody there that knows how to sharpen a chain properly and how to fix things is a godsend. We were in Florida and the North Carolina guys, there's this one little old guy, antique as can be, and he set up a little tent. And then as we were heading out to work, he was going to bed. And he slept all day. And then at dinner, he got up and he had his dinner. And then he'd go out as we came in, he was out in the parking lot, bring me your saws, bring me your saws. And you lined up all your saws outside of his tent. And all night, he'd be up. And he'd sharpen them, he'd clean them out, he'd check everything. And when you got the thing the next morning, they're all lined back up and they're all pristine and pretty and ready to go. And he's going to bed. Oh my gosh, that was so nice to have that guy. I've been looking for a guy like that ever since. You know, so if you got anybody in your group, maybe they can't go out and run the chainsaws, but they know the saws. Yeah, recruit that guy too. We need him. Okay? Otherwise, you got to maintain all your own gear. One of my goals, and I know this is a pie-in-the-sky goal, I really would love for all the units in Maryland, Delaware to have the same make and model saws so that we could have interchangeable parts with each other, that if your team is out and you've got a problem, well, maybe I've got that part because I've got that same saw. You know, that's too much to ask just because saws are very expensive and you got what you got, but I would love to be able to have a cache of parts of the most logical things, the things that break the most, that we can be able to support one another out in the field.
Start collecting all the broken ones. And then
all right, people talk about the post-emergency recovery period, which is the rebuild. Back in the old days, Baptist had something called Baptist Builders. They kind of got absorbed into Send Relief, and I don't know where they fall right now in the NAM category, if they even exist anymore. But that's your local churches that are going in the post-emergency time frame of going down doing the long-term rebuild. That's great, but that's not considered disaster relief. We are truly an emergency response group, and we are not doing rebuild. We are doing that emergency, what is needed right now to hopefully keep the family in their home until the rebuild guys can catch up. But the paperwork, again, is important. As you work on a house, you know, you find out from the homeowner, do they have insurance? You know, do they have a plan for getting this fixed? We were in Katrina, and dear little old lady, her and her husband bought this house right after World War II. When he got out of the service, they got married, and they bought this house. And they didn't even pay $10,000 for the house when they bought it. And he's long since passed. And she just couldn't see putting money into insurance on the house. It's a $10,000 house in her mind. You know, and she's got her medical bills and everything else. So she let her homeowner's insurance lapse because she couldn't afford it. And now she's got a $30,000 tree went through the roof. You know, so that needs to be documented, and we share that with our partners. It may not be a Baptist group that goes and helps rebuild that house. Hopefully somebody will get there and help rebuild that house, but it may not be a Baptist group. You kind of got to, again, disaster relief. We deal with strange bedfellows sometimes. I mean, it could be a Mormon group. It could be a non-religious group, completely secular. You're seeing several military groups of military veterans that are banding together and doing projects together from a secular basis. So they're starting to show up out there. We don't know who, but again, what we care about is that that person's house gets fixed so that this little old lady can live in her house. So it's kind of one of those, the way it goes kind of things. On a mission, your crew leader, as Ellen said, wearing a blue hat, I don't wear hats usually, will have the job owner's form. So there's a form that the homeowners have to fill out. That's usually your assessors and chaplain has gotten that. It's signed. We'll show up, and then we will match what we're reading to that house. And it's like, okay. And the next thing we need to do is this something we can do? So as a unit leader, you can deny any job. I can sit there, show up at a job, and look at it, and no, my team is not going to do this. And that's because I don't have the technology or the expertise to do this. I don't have the right equipment or whatever, or it's just generally unsafe. We'll try to find out another team. Maybe they've got more advanced people, equipment, whatever, you know, that they can handle it. Like, we have a team in Maryland out of Pleasant Valley Baptist Church. The pastor, his hobby is cutting down trees, and he is a master at it. So when you get a tree that is too dangerous for us, we call Pastor Clayton and see if he wants to come out and play with it. And if he won't play with it, ain't nobody gonna play with it. But we have that resource. I know Mike Rice was blue hatting our unit one time, pulls up at a house, and the mold was so bad, you could literally watch it advance up the walls. And he said, no. Because one, there's nothing in that house right now that's salvageable. There's no point in going in that house. I'm not getting my people sick and hurt on this. And this, your house is, you know, I hate to say it, I hope he said it in a kind and gentle way, but basically your house needs to be bulldozed and start over. It's, when you see that kind of mold, you're not recovering from that. It's not safe. All right. We will begin each job with prayer. So usually just the team will kind of meet at the back of the trailer. We'll give out assignments. Hey, you know, I want you, Pastor, you're going to be on the ladder and the roof. Take another guy up with you on the roof and you get a figure out what we need up there. And Brother Jack, you're going to go ahead and pull the saws, and we're going to start getting the limbs. You know, give out the assignment, what we're going to do. It's up to your blue hat, your unit leader, to kind of, when he does that 360 walk around and looks everything over, to formulate a game plan and then come back and share that game plan with your team at the back of the trailer. Okay, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And say a quick prayer for safety. And then you go do it. Okay? While you're there, expect to be asked why you are there. That's the key thing about having Maryland, Delaware on a shirt. When you are not in Maryland, Delaware, when you are out somewhere else, and you're like, you're down in Florida, you're in Vermont, people will sit there and go, Maryland, Delaware. Well, I've had people, how much do they pay you to come down here? And I said, they don't pay me. I have to pay my own way. I come down, I give up a week of work and come down here. Why do you do that? I love that question. Because that's why you get, that's your opening to say, well, because Jesus Christ went to the cross for me, and you can give the whole gospel story just as an answer to that one question. Jesus loved me so much. This is what he did for me, and he just asked one thing. Go love your neighbor. And he wasn't real specific on how big that neighborhood was. That's the question you always love when somebody asks, because again, door is now wide open, and you can give the 30-second gospel right there. Don't ever give that opportunity up, okay? Mission safety. These are actually two pastors that went with us one of our Florida trips. The pastor wearing the yellow shirt was probably one of those miserable people I'd ever dealt with. And I love him. He's a super, he's not a miserable person, but he was absolutely miserable the week he was in Florida. Because he made a major mistake. He did not buy his boots when he went to training. We're going to talk about equipment. He didn't buy his boots until he'd signed up for the mission. And a day before he went to Florida to operate in a hurricane where the humidity out there is like 90%, he's now trying to break in a pair of heavy-duty work boots. That poor man was miserable for the whole week, okay? So we'll talk about equipment. Just when you leave here today and you go home, talk to your wife and put your budget together and your Christmas list. This is what I want, so I have it ready for the next season that's about ready to start. But know your limitations, stay hydrated. This mission, the humidity was astronomical. We started off working about 50 minutes, take a 5-10 minute break. By the end of the day, we were working 15 minutes and taking a half hour break. Because it was killing us. Know your limitations, okay? Don't over go beyond what you can do. That's when it gets dangerous, okay? Take a lot of breaks. Do what you're trained to do. Don't do something that you don't know how to do, especially when you're hot and tired. That's not the time to try something new, okay? I did have a guy from Montgomery County that was with us in South Carolina. He was like the Energizer Bunny. The more frustrated he got, the more energy he got. And I could not figure out how to turn him off. You know, it's like, friend, I'm not going to say his name. Friend, you just got to slow down, relax, okay? But he'd get frustrated, and he just, like, that just gave him more energy. So just be careful. Everybody within 10 feet of an operational chainsaw will wear chaps. Okay, these are chaps. I don't care that you don't wear them at home on the farm. You will wear them when you're out with us. Anybody within 10 feet of a running saw has these on. Otherwise, don't get within 10 feet of that saw. Now, why are chaps important? Because of that. Okay. This brother had an accident. He wasn't doing anything silly. He wasn't doing anything foolish. But saws have a tendency to bite. Thankfully, he was wearing his chaps. Okay? This would have been a really bad spot to have a chainsaw dig into your leg. Okay? So you can look at these. That's real. Obviously, they're out of service. They're for training now only. But they did their job. Use the chaps. We have very specific safety rules in mind, and we'll talk about those, and do not break them. Even though some of them may sound silly, trust me, don't break them. Anybody operating under a tree or any other debris, we have helmets. We're actually, for our unit, there's a new set of helmets out, and we're going to order them this fall or this coming spring for next year. Where we have now multiple, we have two different kinds of helmets on the rig. We have our chainsaw helmets, and then we have helmets that we use down in basements. Sometimes you're in very low environments, and you want to have something to protect, because otherwise you're just going to keep beating your head into the pipes and everything in the basement. And OSHA has come out with a new classification of helmet that is a multi-purpose helmet. It's good for chainsaw. It's good for doing tree work. It's good for climbing on roofs, and it's good for everything else. It's one helmet that can do everything. So we're going to be buying them. They're about $60 a piece. So if you're putting your units together, look up those again. So you only have one helmet. Yes. There's a lot of companies that make them. It's got an ANSI number, but it's the latest of the construction helmets. It doesn't look like a construction helmet. Almost looks like kind of like a fireman's helmet in a way. Yeah, it's got eye protection. It's got the ear protection. And it's good for everything. Yes, sir.
We might possibly have a guy that owns a tree company. You don't want his equipment. You'd like his people. Well, you would like the professional, the leadership of him and his people, but not material.
Depends on what he's got and how he's what he's able to do. If he's a specialist and can come in and do the stuff that we can't do, and he's willing to use his equipment for it, like lift trucks and stuff like that. Yeah, sure. They'll probably want to use their own saws. But again, each recovery unit has their own cache of equipment, saws and everything. We spoke about chaps, helmets. Always work in pairs. Nobody works by themselves. You always work with a partner, regardless of what you're doing. Crew leader will usually designate a safety officer, somebody that should know first aid, so your unit should have a first aider with you, and you should have a robust first aid kit with you. That includes the modern Stop the Bleed equipment. On my personal set of chaps, I actually have Stop the Bleed pack on the back of them, so I carry it with me when I'm there. You may have a communications officer, or if you're in an area where cell phones are not working very well, have somebody, one of the ham radio guys with you. If you're lucky, we don't have enough of them, but we'll try to get you one of them. And you need to know before you start, if this area has truly been badly hit by a disaster, what resources are still here? You know, when in Katrina, I could look at a map and see where a hospital was, but that doesn't mean it's still there right now. So you need to know that, and you need to pass that information. If you're the unit leader, you come into an area, they should give you a briefing and tell you, local hospitals are up or local hospitals are down. This is where you go. Is 911 available at this point? You need to know that, okay? Mine does.
Or CBs, I mean.
Not CBs, but well, I have a ham, but they're not fleet-wide. Fleet-wide, we do have some handheld radios that do not require a license. BCMD holds a business band license, but they're very short range. But we do have, and somewhere in the fleet, I know somewhere on the Eastern Shore, there is a cache of handheld radios over here somewhere. I don't know if they're...
CBs are not that expensive. They're easy to install. Yeah. They can have long range as well as...
We actually have thought about going back to what we would refer to as 11 meters. Or 11 meters, and but preferably using SSB. But we have not progressed through that. So... Our comms unit needs to kind of step up. But we do have, as I say, business band radios that are available somewhere in the fleet. I don't know exactly where they're at. I know where mine are.
Oh, just part of that has a big issue about communication.
Communications can be a problem.
Everywhere.
Yep.
And CBs would have been a great solution to that.
Yeah, other than there's a whole lot of people there, and that kind of messes you up. All right, mission safety, we do not let any non-team member within 10 feet of any of our equipment, obviously. We do not let any non-team member. So what a non-team member is, maybe it's one of those send relief blue shirt people, or it might be the local homeowner or the homeowner's family. So like I said, when I let that atheist guy on my trailer, that was rare. I normally do not let anybody other than our team on my rig. Just for safety reasons and safety of my equipment. But so we don't let them, we do take help if the local family's got people that can help. They can drag brush and they can do other things. We were at one of our South Carolina deployments, one of the families we were cutting this neighbor's house, this person's house, and his next door neighbor, there was a tree that went across and he was working on it on his side. But we never got close to him. And pretty much as he got close to the line, we stopped and went somewhere else. Because I did not want our people working on the same tree. Him cutting, us cutting, that creates problems. Bad things happen. He's not prepared for an emergency. He's not wearing chaps or anything else. I am not being responsible for him. Okay? So again, sometimes you got to make those calls. Your clothing cannot be loose-fitting. I'm going to say something controversial here that bugs people, but I'm going to tell you, that picture you saw of the two pastors, one of my big beefs about why they were so, the heat affected them so much, because they were wearing the wrong clothes. Did you notice they were wearing blue jeans? Blue jeans will kill you in that environment. I am absolutely opposed to blue jeans. DR people should never wear them. Best clothing you can possibly wear for disaster relief are the old military battle dress uniform pants, the old BDUs. They were made out of a material that is lightweight, dries quickly, and they have a string on the bottom of them. If you ever notice, the old BDUs, these aren't a pair, But the old BDU's had a string right here. There's some environments that we're working in that you don't know what in the world's crawling around on the ground. So you can take and tie the string on that and then blouse those pants into your boots and nothing's going to crawl up your legs. Okay? And again, they dry quickly. They breathe. I strongly recommend for your DR kit, old-fashioned BDUs. You've got a newer pair of they don't call them BDUs. I don't know what they're made out of. I don't know if they're as good as the old.
Do you use your Air Force ones?
Yeah.
That have
but are they still made the same way that they're still breathable and dry very quickly? Yeah, so you don't have to get camouflage, but that's my personal pet peeve. Your clothing. You're going to wear your yellow shirt. They're expendable. Even your pants are expendable. The two things you want to spend good money on, boots and rain gear. Okay, when it's raining, you're miserable. Boots. Key thing on boots. Everybody thinks about the steel toe. I don't really care about steel toe. What I do care about is the shank. Does your boot have a resistance related or puncture resistant rated shank? I love old fire boots because they have a metal piece in the shank. Nothing comes through the bottom. Because you are much more likely to step on a piece of housing debris that's been blown apart and laying in the yard in the tall grass that you can't see. You're more likely to have something come up through the bottom of your shoe than something crush your toe. Okay? So when you get your boots, make sure you get the boots that have a puncture resistance rating to them. That's important. Yep, that's the key. Again, so don't skimp on your boots and break them in way ahead of time so you're comfortable. Yes, sir.
I was going to say, I get a lot of military surplus stuff off of eBay. You can get a $300 boots for $100.
Yeah, just make sure they're not worn out. I'm also, again, personal, my boots that I wear, as soon as I come back from a mission, I polish them. I polish them up, keep them wax polished, helps keep them waterproof. Okay, take care of your equipment. Again, it's my old public safety mindset. Yes, sir.
How about that? I think they say the word permethrin. That you spray on your clothes, you let it dry in the sun, and they're bug proof. Put it down in 80 and it worked.
Okay.
Yeah. You know
that is? Yeah. Probably a modern version of DEET.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to keep applying.
Yeah. All right, chainsaw gloves. They're preferred but not required. Your gloves, we do have gloves in our unit. I would prefer you buy your own work gloves. Again, we have them on my unit. But if you go buy your own, then you find something that's comfortable for you and it fits you. One thing I would look at is buy the gloves that have the pads that go over your knuckles. So it gives you that, if something hits, it keeps you from crushing your knuckles or whatever. There's several different brands out there. But get yourself a good pair of gloves. You don't need to wear gloves on a chainsaw. It's preferred. But there are some really good chainsaw guys out there that don't want to wear gloves because they want to be able to feel the saw. They want to be able to feel how the saw is reacting, and they're good enough with a saw that they know how to read the saw. So it's not a requirement for wearing gloves. Everything else you need gloves, but you don't have to wear the gloves when you're sawing. There's a couple of signals we want you to know. Universal sign to stop all work, basically to turn everything off. If you see somebody with their hands like that, every piece of machinery comes to a dead stop. Also, usually your team leader should have a whistle, and he'd be blowing a whistle. Okay? This means everything comes to a dead stop. Somebody is spotting. It doesn't have to be the unit leader. Anybody can throw this signal. That's why you don't have to have the whistle with it. But you see this. Everybody, make sure everybody sees it. Somebody has seen something that is a danger. You may not see it. We just had this in South Carolina. Our guys were working. We worked on one side of the house, and some of the guys started working on the other side of the house. And then one of the brothers walks around, and he's just looking at the house, and he realizes that the power line, we know the house has got power, and the main power line is coming out of the house and going down onto the ground and running across the ground, and these guys are slowly clearing, you know, the chainsaw, heading right for that electric line. Whoa, everything come to a stop. Okay, let's sort this out. We're not going any farther. We're not going any farther than this, because there's a fully energized power line on the ground. Be careful. So again, be able to tell your people, everything comes to a dead stop. We got a safety issue. It doesn't mean anybody's done something wrong. It just means somebody has spotted something that you don't see. And that's very common in a situation like that. You know, if you don't have a 360-degree view of what's going on, and there's sometimes that we'll be doing a very difficult cut, something that's challenging, and we'll go ahead and just tell everybody else to stop, bring all the other saws quiet, and let's make this one cut, because this is critical, and if it goes wrong, somebody could get hurt. But now I don't have any other noise going on, and we've got extra eyes watching what's going on and making sure that that procedure goes safely. And then once that drops on the ground, okay, everybody can go start your saws up again. The other is a universal signal to evacuate a structure, and that's going to be 4 blasts of a whistle repeated, or 4 blasts on the car horn. It's 4 blasts of something, whistles, car horns, whatever. I've only seen that happen once in my disaster career, and it was in Katrina. Problem with Louisiana was that there was no enforceable building codes. They built whatever they wanted. Nobody ever checked them. And this big truck, FEMA contractor truck, comes by, and he's picking up the debris. And there is this big claw close down. Have you ever seen the black trucks that come around with a big claw? This claw goes down, and it picks everything up. And every time that claw hits the ground, the claw digs down about 6 or 8 inches into the ground, and it's picking everything up and putting it in the truck. And they're working on the house. We weren't in the house. We were outside doing something. I think we were doing chainsaw. Texas boys were in the house, and this thing comes by, and it boom, and picks up, and as it comes up, it drags a gas line out of the ground with it. Now, you know, no gas line's supposed to be 6 or 8 inches underground, but it rips this gas line completely out of the ground, and now this thing is blowing gas everywhere. Sign to evacuate. Get out of there. Drop whatever you got and get out, okay? This is not safe to be in. I was in a house in Vermont last year. It was only me, because I went down with the homeowner before I let my crew in, because I was doing the what we call the 360, the walk around, get an idea of what's going on. I go down in the basement with the homeowner, and there is an automobile jack holding up a 4x4 that is holding up the floor rafters. And I said, nope. My guys are not coming down here. We're not working on this house. This house is about ready to fall down. Oh, it's all right. It's been like that for years. I don't care how long it's been that way. My people aren't coming into this house. It was a bloody automobile jack holding this house up. Uh-uh. Nope. Sorry about that. Sorry for your luck. I'm not getting my people killed in this. Because, again, what are we going to do? We're going to go down, and we're going to start tearing things apart. Yeah, no. Sorry. So, unit leaders, you have the authority to say, no, this isn't safe, this isn't right. It doesn't have to match building code all the time, but it should at least be somewhat close before you put your people into a dangerous situation. Chainsaws. Remember that a chainsaw blade is traveling at 80 feet per second. That's at idle. At idle, That chain is moving 80 feet per second. It will tear you apart. Why we wear chaps. Why we take our safety seriously with these things, okay? Read and understand the owner's manual. I can tell you that after 20 years, I have no idea where the owner's manual to any of our saws are. So, can't help you with that. Watch what you're doing. Use common sense. Here's one. Chainsaw is only for wood. Okay? And chainsaw is only for wood that is natural. We were in Baltimore. George Blevins and I were in Baltimore, and this flood had happened, and a dock had broke loose from somewhere and floated across whatever river we were on, and now it was laying in a lady's yard, and she wants us to cut this dock up, and George and I are looking at it and go, y'all know George Blevins? He's a super nice guy. Been in disaster relief from the get-go for Maryland, Delaware. Super, super nice guy. Great man of God. I love him. But anyway, George and I, and it's like, this thing is all full of creosote and everything. It's like, that's just going to destroy my saw. Sorry about that. We can't cut that. You know, yeah, it's not for us. So be mindful of that. Don't operate a saw when you're really tired. Don't exceed the, you know, your saw has a certain bar on it. Don't be exceeding that and trying to cut down a tree that's three times the size of your bar. Obviously, watch for electrical lines. Be careful when you fuel the thing. All that stuff. Clear as much out of the, when you get ready, clear as much away from the area as you can. Clear the area so the guy running the saw has got good footing. Okay? Not standing on something. He's got good solid footing. And you want to make sure he's got an escape path. So if something goes wrong, get out of there. Preferably make your escape paths at 45 degree angles. Think of how, if something goes wrong, how this tree is going to land, and have your escape plan at a 45 degree angle off of that. Because if you think about it, let's say the tree is standing. Again, we generally do not cut down standing trees. But if the tree is like this and we think it's going to go this way, you don't want anybody that way or behind it, because remember, it could go the other way. So you want to make sure your escape path is off at a 45 degree angle. It gives you the best chance to get away from it. And that's just it in a diagram. And moving on. Keep your work area clean. That's where your people are dragging the brush out. So you've got one guy on a saw. Usually you'll have somebody next to him with chaps that's taking stuff and just kicking it back so the people that don't have chaps can safely grab it and pull it all the way out. Brother Larry can attest to be careful of local poisonous plants. You know, you just got to be mindful of that. The chainsaw teams, I just said one on a saw, one's moving the material away. Do y'all need a break real quick? Jump up, do some push-ups, jumping jacks real quick, grab a drink, come back, and we'll keep going. We're about halfway through. Yeah, seventh inning stretch. No. I really would love to have a K-12 saw, but